It was perhaps the most unusual sight ever beheld on the august and stately grounds of the Glasgow Institute of Science, founded in 1761 by grant of charter from George III. A large podium, studded with microphones, had been erected on the Great Lawn, directly in front of the administration building. Before it had been set some 36 folding chairs, on which sat reporters from local newspapers, The Times of London, Nature, Oceanography, Time Magazine, and a host of others. To the right of the podium were two television cameras, one from the BBC and the other from CNN. To the podium's left was a large wooden scaffold, upon which sat a large, strange-looking machine of dark metal. A cross between a cigar tube and a pincushion, about 30 feet long, with a bulky attachment protruding from its upper edge. The restless chatter among the reporters grew muted as the main doors to the administration building opened and two men stepped out into the September afternoon sunlight. One was plump and short, with a shock of white hair and wearing a thick tweed coat. The other was tall and quite thin, with rather severe features, light brown hair, and alert gray eyes. Unlike the first man, he was dressed in a conservative dark suit. The two approached the podium, and the older man cleared his throat. "Ladies and gentlemen of the press," he began, "thank you for coming. I am Colin Reed, Provost of the Glasgow Institute of Science, and to my right is Jeremy Logan." Reed took a sip from a glass of water on one side of the podium, cleared his throat again. "You may well know of Dr. Logan's work. He is perhaps the only and certainly the preeminent enigmologist operating in the world today. His job is to investigate, interpret, and explain the, for lack of a better word, unexplainable. He throws light upon riddles of history. He separates myth from truth and the natural from the supernatural." At Reed's side, Jeremy Logan frowned slightly, as if uncomfortable at this bit of panegyric. "About 2 months ago, we contacted Dr. Logan on his home ground of Yale University and asked him to undertake an assignment for us. That assignment can be briefly explained. To definitively prove or disprove the existence of the creature popularly referred to as the Loch Ness Monster. Dr. Logan has spent the last 6 weeks in Inverness doing precisely that. I will now ask him to share his findings with you." Reed stepped back from the microphones and Logan approached. He surveyed the crowd of reporters for a moment, then began to speak. His voice was relatively low and mild, the mid-Atlantic accent contrasting with Reed's Scottish burr. "The Loch Ness Monster," he began, "is the most famous of all the supposed Scottish lake monsters. Perhaps the most famous of all cryptids. The Institute's aim in hiring me for this particular task was not to stunt the local tourism industry or to put peddlers of Loch Ness iconography out of business. Rather, it was to put a stop to the amateur and misguided attempts at searching for the creature, attempts that have been on the increase recently and, at least twice in the last year, have resulted in deaths by drowning." He took a sip from his own water glass. "I quickly realized that proving the existence of the creature required only one thing, observing it in its element. Proving that the creature does not exist, however, would require a great deal more work. Technology would be my greatest ally. Hence, I persuaded the United States Navy, of which I was once a part, to lend me this one-man research submersible." And Logan waved at the strange-looking machine sitting on the wooden scaffold to his right. "The submersible is equipped with continuous wave radar, synthetic aperture sonar, pulse compression echolocating devices, and numerous other technologies for both underwater mapping and target acquisition. There were two important factors to take into account. First, the lock is quite long and unusually deep, 750 feet in places. Second, so-called sightings of the creature suggested a morphology similar to a plesiosaur, which would put it at something between 20 and 40 feet in length. There were several unknown variables to contend with, of course, such as the creature's range of movement and environmental preferences, but these could not be determined until such time as it was located. I began by familiarizing myself with the features of the submersible and the layout of the lock, both above and below the surface. My service in the Navy made the former relatively straightforward. I spent 1 week in this shakedown period, during which time I uncovered no sign of the creature. Next, I had the Institute procure for me some netting, rather a lot of netting, in fact. Using spools of military-grade nylon mesh, we put together a net 10,000 feet by 800 feet.